Hi, I'm Jay Novacek of the Dallas Cowboys with the Colonel on the radio. Here comes the Colonel.
Oh, yeah, my old friend Jay Novacek from the power days of the Dallas Cowboys. Wow. In just a minute, we're going to get to Sheila Kerr. She believes that she can solve the problems of energy in distressed areas where they just have to have power in a hurry and make it very, very reliable. We, of course, listened to Bob Freeling in the earlier half hour talk about power as a moral imperative, a basic human right, not just a luxury any longer. Now, both Bob and Sheila are going to be at that Global Humanitarian Technology Conference October 21st to the 24th in Seattle, Washington. You can learn more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, just go to the link. Right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set to answer today's query.
Welcome to the Fountain of Useless Information. How can I help you?
Yes, yes, well, I see we have aroused the spirit of the fountain with just the simple act of throwing in some coins to the greedy old fountain. All right, oh spirit of the fountain, here is today's query. This a little word play for you. What does a dendrophobic lumberjack fear most? A dendrophobic lumberjack, oh spirit of the fountain, what does a dendrophobic lumberjack fear?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
Well, oh spirit of the fountain, reach deeply for this one. Dendrophobic lumberjack, what does he fear? What, the dendrophobic lumberjack fears trees, of course. Yes, I wasn't sure you'd guess that one, old spirit of the fountain. All right, back to our program. And all the way from Vermont, I'm going to introduce you to Sheila Kerr. Now, Sheila is a co-owner of Windstream. In the earlier earlier half hour, we heard from Bob Freeling that there's a moral imperative to energy, that it's a basic human right. And Sheila Kerr is an exhibitor at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, where Bob is a speaker, going on October 21st through the 24th in Seattle, Washington. And Sheila has a solution for what happens when the sun doesn't shine and the wind doesn't blow and there's no way of harvesting any power. She knows how to solve those problems. So we were very, very interested in getting Sheila on the program to explain to us, you know, what goes on in these developing countries where power is a basic human right. All right, let's talk to Sheila. Welcome to the program, Sheila.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now then, this is Windstream Power. You're a family business. It goes back to 1974, I understand. You started in the eastern townships of Quebec, and in the early years focused on the development of tough little permanent magnet DC generators and small wind and human power systems. How did that happen to come about?
Well, in the early 1970s, my father, who's a physicist, decided to go into business for himself, and his main interest was remote power systems. And so in his little workshop in Quebec, he was winding his own permanent magnet DC generators, and it just kind of went from there.
Wow! So, and then you were spending a lot of time in the woods and doing things in remote settings in forestry camps in northern British Columbia and Alberta and things like that. And so, these little power generators became quite useful.
Well, I think primarily for me, anyway, when I was in my 30s, I was living in northern British Columbia, and I was a cook in forestry camps, and so we were generally, for the most part, dropped off by helicopter, and so there was no power source whatsoever, and so I became very acquainted with how to survive and how to function in an environment where there was no external power, and so 12-volt, remote 12-volt power systems were really useful for radios and other small appliances.
So your father decided that, gee whiz, he puts his mind to it, maybe he can come up with some little portable generator that can work in remote areas where you don't have any other particular source to drive them, so they might need some wind power or some human power or something like that. I'm going to want you to describe some of these things here in just a minute. But he did it as kind of a lark at first and then thought, hey, wait a minute, maybe there would be a driving need for this sort of thing. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, as word got out, we were getting calls from all over the world to supply people with different sources of power. And a good example of this is in 2006, we connected with a man in Russia who needed many hundreds of our human power generators, and these are hand or foot crank generators. And he distributed these throughout Siberia for their forestry camps for their radio communications. And these little generators are very, very durable, hardy little things that when you pedal, you can either charge a battery or you can connect to a DC direct 12-volt appliance.
Now, what you know, your dad did these things, and he played around with them a little bit, and then all of a sudden, he put them to use, and then word got out to different areas that you had these things. How did the word get out? I mean, news sources like mine or something, or what did you do to kind of move the business forward? I guess you were a little girl at the time too, because this was in 1974. How did that all come about?
Well, I think that you know. He put ads in Popular Science and Popular Mechanics, and you know, he got some exposure through newspapers, I suppose. You know, it's just over a very long period of time, and certainly as he went along, events like Y2K in 1999 provided a huge sort of stage for him. Because so many people were concerned about losing power, and suddenly we had a huge surge in business. And I'm sure there are thousands of human power generators around North America as a result, hopefully being used, but maybe not all of them, because nothing really happened in the end with Y2K. But it's just, you know, this has been over the last almost 40 years that he's been doing this, and he actually retired in 2006 when I took over. And he continues to be involved in renewable energy, primarily with tidal power.
Well, Sheila, yeah, you had told me before we began the interview that you get calls from survivalists all the time and doomsday people who are saying, "Gee, you know, we might want one of these units." But so I can imagine that would be very popular, certainly at times of Y2K and some other times when people think, "Gee whiz, it'd be nice to have the power." But any of us could want these kind of power units, and we'll get into the remote areas and the need there in just a little bit. But tell us how these things work. And what sort of different types you have? I said you've got hand power, but you have wind power and other stuff too.
Well, we have two human power devices. One is operated with a bicycle, and the other uses a bicycle-like crank, and then has hand pedals or foot pedals. And so, basically, these are just very simple devices that transform your movement, human movement, into electricity. And so, by pedaling a bicycle or by just hand cranking, when you connect to a 12-volt battery, then you produce current, which in effect charges a battery or can power a small 12-volt appliance. So it's a very, very simple technology. It uses a permanent magnet DC generator, which is really just, you know, copper and magnets, and it's accessible. It's always there when you need it. There's nothing that can... You know, with a solar panel or with wind power, it relies on an energy source that can stop and start, that can be there or not be there. But with human power, all it takes is just a person who's capable to pedal to produce electricity. And so they're very practical in that regard.
Well, you mentioned bicycle. You're talking about a stationary bike now. You're not talking about somebody who's pedaling a bike down the roadway and charging their village batteries too, right?
That's right. Yeah, I should clarify. It's a trainer stand. So it's basically a sort of an A-frame stand where you drop any kind of bicycle into the stand and tighten it down, and then the rear wheel of the tire makes contact with a friction drum that's pressed onto the generator shaft. And somebody pedals, then they're able to create electricity to charge a battery. That's the most common application with that one.
Okay, so you're charging it. A 12-volt battery. Now, this is a standard, like, automobile-type battery, or this be a motorcycle battery, or what kind of 12-volt batteries is pretty common?
For the most part, you know, a battery can vary in its capacity. So a car battery might have a lot of capacity, whereas another smaller 12-volt battery might have less. And so typically with human power applications, we usually pair it up with a smaller battery so that it takes less time to charge it up. That also means there's less power available, but if we keep everything in sort of context of, you know, human power, the average person might be able to produce 100 watts or less. And so we bring everything down to scale. And so I usually recommend, you know, for instance, in a residential setting in the United States, and someone wants to incorporate human power into their house, I always suggest they dedicate one small appliance, one or two small appliances that draw under 100 watts to use with their human power generator, because it makes it all possible. If a person wanted to power a huge flat screen TV that took 600 watts to run, it would be too difficult. And so not only does human power provide an educational experience around how much power stuff takes, we also have the physical experience of producing power. And so if it's really difficult to produce 100 watts, we really get a sense of how much it's taking. And so we try and close the loop that way by dedicating small appliances as human power. So we have this very intimate relationship with the power that we're using.
All right, so this... I would presume then, if you were going to recharge an automobile battery, that it would take a little bit of time to do it. But if you're going to do a radio or maybe a small light bulb or something that doesn't draw a whole lot of a wattage, a lot of amperage, that it is more practical. Does that rule out then refrigeration?
I would say it doesn't rule it out, because, again, it would depend on the type of refrigerator and how much power it was drawing. But I would say for the most part, we stick with small appliances. And this is something that's important to us, because we want to branch out into developing nations where electricity is often very difficult to come by, and where small things like radios and simple light that really don't require a lot of power would be easily made available with a human power generator or some other, you know, a bicycle or even small wind power. And so I think in North America or Europe and Japan, places where huge amounts of electricity are used on a daily basis and consumed by people without a lot of knowledge of how much that actually is, versus countries where there's very little electrification, we want to see our generators used in the most practical way for small appliances and small things that would really make a difference in people's lives. Whereas around here, it's a lot of fun to try out a human power generator for the educational experience, just to highlight how much we take electricity for granted. But in a developing nation where there isn't very much, it would be wonderful for us to see a human power generator in a really practical application that made a difference in somebody's life.
What about your wind power stuff? You do have wind power generators too, did you say?
Well, that's right. We manufacture permanent magnet DC generators that are built into wind turbines, and those are used by people all around the world. And there's a company we work closely with in Germany that makes a small wind turbine that's more or less portable. And so yes, I mean, they can be used for refrigeration. And you know, again, depending on the size of the refrigeration unit, human power would be able to keep it running. I'm thinking more along the lines of, Western size refrigerators that are kind of big. And so, no, human power wouldn't work. But certainly in a place that needed, any kind of power that was on a small scale. And the thing with the human power generator or a bike power generator or wind is that their charging cycles can happen whenever you need them to. So if a battery was getting low that was in turn charging or, providing power for a fridge, then a person can start pedaling to top it up. And so it's a pretty interactive experience. But, again, it always provides power. It makes power available when there isn't any. In terms of the schools, we do bring them around to schools. We sell them to educators all around the country that incorporate these into their physics or science programs. And there's many schools, too, that will use these. They'll have a little human-powered corner in their classroom or you know, in some part of the school, and so children have to pedal if they want to charge up their cell phones or if they want to use a particular kind of, you know,
that's quite,
know, there's a variety of things they might want to use, but
really funny.
But making the human power part of their curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a really successful place for us. And as far as museums go, we have a lot of exhibits around the country that basically compare how much power various things take. So,
well, I had to smile because it probably really does impress the kids when they get down and have to pedal this stuff to find out what it takes to do things. And, of course, with pumping of water, my golly, the municipalities, that's the major source of their electrical use is pumping water. So I can see where that would be quite a valuable thing. Now, these units, you say they're simple, they're magnets, and it's out of engineering that has been known, you know, for a long time. But have you been able to increase, let's say, the amperage output or the wattage of these things over the period of years, or you're pretty well stuck with the same technology that we had for the past 50 years?
Well, that's a really good question, and the truth is we are more or less, I hesitate to say stuck because, you know, it sounds like we're in a bad place, but the amperage is pretty much consistent with what it's always been, and that is because of the generators. And so, you know, current is a product of with our generators anyway, with RPM and load, and so meaning how fast a person is able to spin the generator when they're pedaling, when they're connected to a battery. And so I think what we're trying to do is to, you know, not only are we educating consumers about how electricity works and how much things take to run, you know, it allows us to have a sense of how much it takes to create the current, which is, you know, quite a bit of electricity, or quite a bit of exercise, rather. So, you know, back in the Second World War, when, you know, out on the front, people were pedaling bicycles to have their radios work, it's really, the technology really hasn't changed. It's very simple, you know, and it still works. I think where technology is changing is with batteries and how energy is stored, and in terms of wind power and solar power and all these different technologies, they are changing and they're getting better. They're becoming more efficient, and I really support that. In terms of Windstream and our work, we're pretty much staying where we are, and our goal in terms of growth and change is to break into new markets and to provide power in places where it's not available and where the amount of current that our products makes would be adequate for what they need. I think the big challenge is in many countries in Africa and other developing nations, South America, India, parts of China, most people don't have the ability to own a lot of things. They don't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to find a way to make it possible to put these in their hands, and that's our big challenge.
Well, I can imagine what a dying need that would be, but I would think that probably what you've done with these bicycle things is added more gears the way someone might do with a 10-speed bicycle, so you can start out getting the generator rolling and gradually gear it up so that you can get it spinning a great deal with less taxing of the humans.
Well, what I wanted to say is that even though the technology hasn't really changed since, you know, the 1930s, let's say, there's two factors that remain the same. Human power, human beings, we only have so much energy. And even though a person could make a huge bike power generator with a very heavy flywheel and even something like a water wheel or a gerbil cage and have people running in it, there still is that human power is limited because we're only human. And so even though we can create better technology, we can't produce that much more power.
You have a website where people can see these units?
Yeah, we do. Our website is windstreampower.com, and in that website we have a lot of links to other companies that are working in human power, and so I think in some ways it's always been a grassroots initiative, and I really like to connect with other people that are working on different projects that are related to what we're doing. So yeah.
Well, the exciting thing is we're going to get to see you at the big Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on October 21st to the 24th in Seattle, Washington, where you're going to be featured, and we're going to actually get to see the demonstration of your particular units and the other things that you're going to have there. You're going to be right on the spot. We're going to get to meet you and talk to you and everything else. You're going out there, I guess. You're taking anybody with you?
You know, I'm going to be going on my own this time. We're a very small company, and so I'm gonna handle this one on my own. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm really looking forward to seeing what other people are going to be bringing to the conference as well. And I look forward to the opportunity to just, you know, meet people and describe what we're doing and have something there to show.
You're going to enjoy it very much. These are very dedicated humanitarian people. I've talked to many of them, and they're good friends of mine, and they work in remote areas of the world. You're going to be fascinated with the things that you have, and you're going to make some real good friends there. I have no doubt about it. So we're pretty excited about seeing you, and I want to remind the audience that if they want more information on the Global Humanitarian Conference, their website is IEEEGHTC.org. That would be IEEEGHTC for Global Humanitarian Technology Conference.org. There's also a link to that particular conference at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz, on the right-hand side of the screen. Sheila Kerr, co-owner of Windstream Power, the family business in Vermont, up on Lake Champlain in Ferrisburg, Vermont. It's so good to have you with us, and we look forward to seeing you at the IEEE Global Humanitarian Technology Conference, October 21st to the 24th in Seattle, Washington. Thanks so much for taking the time to be with us today.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
One of the things that I've tried to embrace is the complexity of these challenges, that these aren't simple. I think there's still way too many people in the world who are trying to find those silver bullet solutions, you know, the next best seed, the next piece of, you know, single innovation that's going to sort of transform, you know, the developing world. It's not that simple. So even the mobile platforms will only work if there are people innovating in terms of the tools and apps that can be used on those platforms, if there are buyers and sellers for those tools and apps and so on. It's complex stuff. And I would just say to anybody who's interested in this space, embrace that complexity, try and understand that complexity, and then try and work out how to package solutions, you know, that can respond to the complexity of those challenges. This is not simple stuff. Simon Winter, Senior Vice President, Development, TechnoServe.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you. I